White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew, it is May 2nd, 2013, and this is episode 45, chapter 40. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and Hadding is here too, somewhere. Well, what happened?
Oh, yes, here I am.
Okay. Carolyn and.
Yes.
And Hadding Scott. Okay, and we're back on track after our little detour last week with why the Jews dislike the Morgenthau Report tonight. And what we're going to find, in my opinion, is that the now familiar trick or tactic that Jews use, that of exaggeration and of suppressing information they don't like, is something that we're familiar with. I just said that. Okay, I'm confusing myself. Now, some questions we might ask as we're listening to this is, to what can we liken this today? And I think we'll find plenty of parallels to our current experiences. We might also ask, are there any other people like the Jews of whom we are so unwilling to tell the truth about them because it's just not very nice? There are those people who have more delicate natures and they don't like to say, you know, to even think that there are people that, you know, that are quite so bad as the Jews are, and maybe some other types, other people that have some bad characters, bad parts of their character. And they just don't like to talk about it. Or we've been taught, haven't we, Hadding? I think it's that we've been taught not to. Whereas in the past, if we go back far enough, people didn't have any problem with telling the truth about these things.
Well, you know, Henry Ford, or whoever wrote this, mentioned in some of the early chapters that it was considered somehow rude or bad manners or somehow inappropriate to criticize Jews, even in his day. You know, they were sort of they were breaking the taboo by publishing this International Jew series.
Well, right. Even then, that was already in place. And that's what, but if you go back, you know, a few hundred years or so, let's go way back, maybe, you know, there was no problem with that. But maybe there was problems in some other ways with telling the truth about people. I don't know, but this whole idea that you can't, that people are individuals, and therefore in any group you just find this whole range of individuals, and so you can't talk about them as a group.
That's kind of an Enlightenment idea, where mm-hmm. you know, all men are created equal, and each one is born a tabula rasa, and has all kinds of different potentials in him, and you shouldn't therefore judge him as a member of a group.
That's right.
From the 1700s.
Well, that's where we went wrong, and that's pretty well understood because you hear people saying that all the time, where it started in the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment had some good things, but it also brought along, and I think everything is like that. Everything has its good side and its bad side, and sooner we realize that, the better we cannot consider that something is just all good or all bad. Well, now I'm kind of saying that, but, you know, it's... I'm saying what I think we shouldn't say, but it's not, it's a little bit different. Everything, you know, has its, well, I'm going to go off into something way beyond, so I'm going to stop right here, and let's just let you get started reading chapter 40.
All right, chapter XL 40, Why the Jews Dislike the Morgenthau Report. It seems a far cry from the Jewish question in the United States to the same question in Poland. But inasmuch as the Jews of the United States are constantly referring to Poland for propaganda purposes, inasmuch as there are 250,000 Polish Jews arriving in the United States on a schedule made by their brethren here, and inasmuch as the people of Poland had their own illuminating experience, have had their own illuminating experience with the World Program, it would seem that Poland has something to teach the United States in this respect.
Mm-hmm.
Especially is this true, since it is impossible to pick up an American newspaper without finding traces of Jewish anti-Polish propaganda. A propaganda which is designed to take our eyes away from the thing that is transpiring at the port of New York. If a reader of these articles should say, "Let us not think about Poland, let us think about the United States," the answer is that he already is thinking about Poland the way the Jews of the United States want him to think. And the fact that he is thinking according to Jewish wishes in this respect incapacitates him up to a certain point to understand the entire Jewish question in this country. Three chapters back in this series, we presented part of a hearing before a United States Senate committee on the census question as it affected the Jew. The immigration question appeared as part of that inquiry. Then followed an article which showed that Jewish authorities adopt principles exactly opposite to those which had been defended before the United States senators. A third article followed, showing how Jewish leaders resent the influence of the modern state upon Judaism. All these subjects are essential to a well-rounded understanding of the Jewish question as a whole, in its relation to the United States. Today we go back to the home of that quarter of a million people who are so rapidly being landed on our shores, to see what they did there, and to find the basis for Jewish propaganda statements that these people are fleeing from persecution. We have five official witnesses whose observations have been printed under the seals of the United States and the British governments. The American document is a message from the President of the United States transmitting pursuant to a Senate resolution of October 28, 1919, a communication from the Secretary of State submitting a report by the Honorable Henry Morgenthau on the work of the mission of the United States to Poland. It is Senate document number 177.
Now, go ahead and say that.
Henry Morgenthau Sr., mm-hmm. father of the Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr., Hans Morgenthau, who was responsible for the Morgenthau plan of starving Germany after World War II.
Yeah, so his was the Morgenthau plan. This is the Morgenthau report of his father.
Yeah, Henry Morgenthau Sr. was born in Baden, Germany.
Right, and he actually called his son Hans, huh?
Apparently.
Yeah. Oh, all these good German Jews. Well, these Polish Jews are the international Jew really is troubled by them, and I'm happy that they are. Because they're pretty smart people writing this and working on this, and they see this huge amount of Polish Jews is not good for the United States. And of course, we can point out how they were not good, but. And what was interesting in the very beginning is what said that they were arriving on schedule made by their brethren here. So yeah. The Jews here really wanted to bring them over. And that's really part of what this whole chapter is about, is that they were trying to drum up a lot of propaganda to make it seem like these poor Jews, Polish Jews, were being so persecuted they had to find a home here.
Well, yeah, there's a famous article that you've probably seen over and over about how 6 million Jews were dying in Poland at the end of World War I.
Well, yeah, was it only Poland or sometimes it was somewhere else?
Yeah, it was focused on Poland on that occasion.
Yeah, yeah, I know. They were using that then, and that is so. Here, now this is one, just one instance out of innumerable ones that shows how they maneuver, how they control the news, and what gets printed, what gets paid attention to. Because the fact that there were all these reports about 6 million Jews after World War I, and even before World War I, there is some of them, and they've been using the 6 million figure forever, and that should right there, that discredits what they're saying about that, and yet nobody knows about it, or if they do, they just ignore it, I guess. I don't know. You can't get anywhere with it. A whole book has been written about it.
Okay. This document includes also a supplementary report signed by Brigadier General Edgar Jadwin, United States Army. There is a certain mystery about this document. Though an edition was printed for public circulation, it soon became extremely rare. It seemed to disappear almost overnight. The copy from which this present examination is made was secured with the utmost difficulty. The head of that American mission, which remained in Poland from July 13th to September 13th, 1919, was Henry Morgenthau, an American Jew who had been United States Minister to Turkey, a man of excellent public and private reputation. It is commonly said that the Jews did not like his report, hence its scarcity. This much appears. The Jewish press has never made much of it. It is not cited in Jewish propaganda. It has not had the endorsement of American Jewry. The reason appears to be this, that it told the calm truth about the situation of the Jews in Poland and made very few, very fair observations. But it is indirectly that American Jews show the opinion which they hold of the Morgenthau Report, and it comes about in this way. When the American mission left Poland, the British mission arrived and remained until December. The chief member of the British mission was an English Jew, Sir Stuart Samuel, whose brother, Herbert, is now High Commissioner of Palestine. And they're both sons, I believe, of Samuel Montagu.
Yeah, we talked about him quite a bit at one of the previous chapters, remember? In fact, we had to look into it and figure it all out, who was who and what was going on. But they changed their name. I know he changed his name from their last
Samuel.
Name was Samuel. Yeah, and then they changed it to put Samuel his first name and made Montague's last name. No, they're not Montagues, but they just managed to steal, to take that name. Slippery stuff. And now they seem like real British people.
He was accompanied by it might be the grandson of Samuel Montagu, I'm not sure. He was accompanied by a British military officer, Captain P. Wright, who also submitted a supplementary report. The two reports were submitted with an introductory report by Sir H. Rumbold, British representative at Warsaw. Now, of all five reports, the Morgenthau, Samuel, Jadwin, Wright, and Rumbold reports, the Jews of the United States have circulated only one, the Samuel report.
Now, two of these reports of the five were Jewish representatives that they sent, and the other three were not Jewish.
Actually, I'm suspicious of Rumbold because he has Montagu in his name.
Oh, maybe he's one of the members of the family.
Yeah.
You mean?
I suspect it, but anyway.
Okay.
It has been printed in full in newspapers at advertising rates. It has been circulated broadcast as an American Jewish Congress bulletin. Any number of Samuel reports may be obtained, but none of the report which a member of the American Diplomatic Service made and which the President of the United States transmitted as a message to the Senate. Why? Because four reports examined the situation all around and reported it without bias. And if they were printed in the United States and spread broadcast before the public, it would throw an entirely different light on the Jewish propaganda in favor of Polish immigration in enormous numbers. Even when the Jews of the United States published the Samuel report, they did not publish the Captain Wright report, which accompanied it. In the American Jewish Congress bulletin, the Wright report was condensed, mutilated, and shorn of its real meaning. While in the Maccabean, the reports of Rumbold and Wright are treated without courtesy, and the Samuel report published in full. That the reader may form his own conclusions, the testimony of the five official witnesses, or six if we count Homer H. Johnson, who signed the American report with General Jadwin, will be given on the principal points. The agreements and disagreements will therefore be noticeable.
Okay, before we go on to that now, let's make it clear to the listeners that what they're saying here is that the Jews will only talk about one of the reports. They don't even like that one. But the others, they've somehow managed to make them disappear. They're not actually disappeared, but people don't hear about them much because they won't say anything about them in their press.
Yeah, basically, if the Jewish-owned mass media don't trumpet something from the rooftops, the general public doesn't know about it.
That's right. That's what they did.
And the one that the Jews liked was the one by Sir Stuart Samuel.
Right, the British Jew.
Okay, so here we are. It's number one. On the general subject of persecution, Sir Stuart Samuel says,
"Poles generally are of a generous nature, and if present incitements of the press were repressed by a strong official hand, Jews would be able to live, as they have done for the past 800 years, on good terms with their fellow citizens in Poland."
Note how easily Sir Stuart talks about a repression of the press. The Polish press has at last obtained freedom of writing. It is exercising a privilege which the Jewish press of Poland has always had. But now that it speaks freely of Jews, repress it with a strong hand, says Sir Stuart. He would not dare suggest that in England, where the press also is finding its freedom. As to the Yiddish press in Poland, the reader will find some information in Israel Friedlander's essay, The Problem of Polish Jewry. Friedlander was a Jew, and his book is published by a Jewish house in Cincinnati. Friedlander says, "The Yiddish press sprang up and began a powerful civilizing agency among the Jews of Poland. The extent of its influence may be gathered from the fact, which curiously enough is pointed out reproachfully by the Poles, that the leading Yiddish newspaper of Warsaw commanded but a few years ago a larger circulation than that of all the Polish newspapers combined." Henry Morgenthau says, in Part 7, "The soldiers had been inflamed by the charge that the Jews were Bolsheviks. While at Lemberg it was associated with the idea that the Jews were making common cause with the Ukrainians. These excesses were, therefore, political as well as anti-Semitic in character." And again in Part 8, "Just as the Jews would resent being condemned as a race for the action of a few of their co-religionists,
so would it be correspondingly unfair to condemn the Polish nation as a whole for the violence committed by uncontrolled troops or local mobs. These excesses were apparently not premeditated, for if they had been part of a preconceived plan, the number of victims would have run into the thousands, instead of amounting to about 280. It is believed that these excesses were the result of a widespread anti-Semitic prejudice aggravated by the belief that the Jewish inhabitants were politically hostile to the Polish state. Sir H. Rumbold says, "It is giving the Jews very little real assistance." Excuse me. "It is giving the Jews very real assistance to single out, as is sometimes done, for reprobation and protest, the country where they have perhaps suffered least." Captain H. Wright says, "It is an explanation often given of what may be called, according to the point of view, the idiosyncrasies or defects of the Jews, that they have been an oppressed and persecuted people. This is an idea so charitable and humane that I should like to think it not only of the Jews, but of every other people. It has every merit as a theory, except that of being true. When one thinks of what happened to the other racial, religious, and linguistic minorities of Europe in modern times, the Jews appear not as the most persecuted, but as the most favored people of Europe." Brigadier General Jadwin states clearly that the persecution cry may be regarded as propaganda. He says, "The disorders of November 21st to 23rd in Lemberg became, like the excesses in Lithuania, a weapon of foreign anti-Polish propaganda. The press bureau of the Central Powers, in whose interest it lay to discredit the Polish Republic before the world, permitted the publication of articles in which an eyewitness estimated the number of victims between 2,500 and 3,000, although the extreme number furnished by the local Jewish committee was 76. And again, "In common with all free governments of the world, Poland is faced with the danger of the political and international propaganda to which the war has given rise. The coloring, the invention, the suppression of news, the subornation of newspapers by many different methods, and the poisoning by secret influences of the instruments affecting public opinion, in short, all the methods of malevolent propaganda, are a menace from which Poland is a notable sufferer." Of course, all this propaganda has been Jewish. The methods described are typically Jewish.
Exaggeration. That's their main method right here, right?
Well,
2,500 to 3,000 victims. When it turns out, it's going to turn out to be much. When he says it turns out to be. 76.
Yeah, well, you could call that the big lie theory, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking about the number killed, Mr. Morgenthau estimates the total at 258, while Sir H. Rumbold says that only 18 were killed in Poland proper, the others having been killed in the disorders of the war zone. Sir Stuart Samuel estimates the total killed at 348.
He is the high end.
Yeah. Number two, on the general cause of Jewish trouble before the war. Sir Stuart Samuel.
"The Jews in Poland and Galicia number about 3 million. Public opinion had been roused against them by the institution of a virulent boycott. This boycott dates from shortly after the by-election for the Duma, which took place in Warsaw in 1912. Business relations between Poland and Russia were very considerable in the past and were generally in the hands of the Jews, not only in the handling of the goods exported, but also in their manufacture. Initiative in business matters is almost entirely the prerogative of the Jewish population. Nearly the whole of the estate agents who act for the Polish nobility are of the Jewish race. Attention must be paid to the fact that the Jews form the middle class almost in its entirety. Above are the aristocracy, and below are the peasants. Their relations with the peasants are not unsatisfactory. The young peasants cannot read the newspapers and are therefore but slightly contaminated by anti-Semitism until they enter the army. I was informed that it is not at all unusual for Polish peasants to avail themselves of the arbitrament of the Jewish rabbi's courts.
That shows the Jews to have occupied a very favorable position in Poland, and is to be remembered in connection with the previous quotation from Sir Stuart, in which he says that if the incitements of the press were repressed by a strong official hand,
the Jews would be able to live, as they have done for the past 800 years, on good terms with their fellow citizens in Poland.
Let us take the points made by Sir Stuart and observe what the other witnesses say about them. Beginning with the point as to the Jews' monopoly of the business in Poland, Sir H. Rumbold.
Sir Stuart Samuel would appear to be mistaken in his appreciation of the part played by the Jews in the pre-war business relations between Poland and Russia, and in the industry of the former country. Whereas it is true that goods exported from Poland were to a large extent handled by the Jews, only a small percentage of those goods were actually manufactured by them.
Captain P. Wright.
In Poland, until the last generation, all businessmen were Jews. The Poles were peasants or landowners and left commerce to the Jews. Even now, certainly much more than half, and perhaps as much as three-quarters, of businessmen are Jews. For both town and country, I think it a true generalization to say that the East Jews are hardly ever producers, but nearly always middlemen. Economically, the Jews appear at the very outset as dealers, not as producers, nor even as artisans, and chiefly dealers in money. In course of time, the whole business and commerce of Poland became theirs, and they did nothing else.
Okay. With regard now, to...
Yeah, well, you know, just to emphasize here, that this is this totally different story, that the Jews put out the story of how they've been victims of whites, of the non-Jews all through these years and centuries and so on. And yet the truth here that they're bringing forth is that the Jews have had a favored position in Poland and in other places too. But here we're just talking about Poland for sure. And that the average Polish person was in the peasant class. And they are under the Jews, and they were taken advantage of by Jews, too. But
and they were illiterate, and they didn't know anything about Jews.
Well, that's right. They didn't know anything, and they were so credible, because they're not the most highly, naturally, well, they're not stupid, but they're not the most intelligent people. So, they were really under the Catholic Church and all those teachings. They were totally credible. Incredulous about what the church taught them, and the church taught them that all this worldly stuff was of the devil, and they shouldn't participate in it. Let the Jews do it, let the Jews take care of business and the money lending and all that. And the Jews were not good, but they were, that was their, they had to handle that part of it. So these Polish people just remained poor and not running anything themselves. And then another thing is that their own the Polish aristocratic class didn't give a darn about this peasant class and just let them suffer and put the Jews in to run the stuff so that they could just live the good life. They were a bunch of lazy no goods. And so this whole Polish nation, whatever it has suffered from all of its Jews and letting all those Jews in and letting them get more powerful, it's their own fault. It's the flaws that they had, that they didn't try to look after their nation in the way that, you know, I don't know, I'm not going to make comparisons, but, you know, in a better way where they really cared about their people. They didn't. They cared about their own personal, the aristocrats did. They cared about their own personal well-being. And if you're born into that lifestyle and you're taught that, you know, well, then you just kind of accept it and think that it's the right way. So that's the way it was in Poland for all those hundreds of years.
Yeah. Well, class division, that's how the Jews can succeed in a society, if the society is divided by class or by other divisions.
Yes, good.
Captain P. Wright. Well, let's see. With regard to the estate agents mentioned by Sir Stuart Samuel, Captain P. Wright says, Poland is an agricultural country, but the East Jews, unlike the West Jews, play a large part in its country life. Every estate and every village has its Jew, who holds a sort of hereditary position in them. He markets the produce of the peasants and makes their purchases for them in the town. Every Polish landowner or noble had his own Jew, who did all his business for him, managed the commercial part of his estate, and found him money. Besides this, nearly all the population of nearly all the small country towns is Jewish. Corn and leather dealers, storekeepers and peddlers, and such like. Regarding Sir Stuart's assertion that Jews form the middle class almost in its entirety, with the nobles above them and the peasants beneath them, a typical Jewish position, dividing Gentile society and standing between the parts. This illustration may help to make it clear. Captain P. Wright. It is instructive to try and imagine what England would be like under the same conditions. Arriving in London, a stranger would find every second or third person a Jew, almost all the poorer quarters and slums Jewish, and thousands of synagogues. Arriving in Newbury, he would find practically the whole town Jewish, and nearly every printed inscription in Hebrew characters. Penetrating into Berkshire, he would find the only storekeeper in most small villages a Jew, and small market towns mostly composed of Jewish hovels. Going on to Birmingham, he would find all the factories owned by Jews, and two shops out of three with Jewish names. Captain Wright is trying to give the people at home a picture of conditions in order that they may understand how Poland feels. The Jewish press strongly resented this. Sir Stuart Samuel's report is notable for the number of things he mentioned, and the few he explained. 3. On the general cause of trouble arising during the war. Sir Stuart Samuel.
The fact of their language being akin to the German often led to their being employed during the German occupation in preference to other Poles. This circumstance caused the Jews to be accused of having bad business relations with the Germans. The government publicly declared its disapproval of boycotting, but a certain discrimination seems to have been made in the re-employment of those who served under the German occupation. I find that many Jews who thus served have been relieved of their offices and not reinstated, whereas I can find no evidence of similar procedure in regard to other Poles.
Sir H. Rumbold.
The fact of the Yiddish being akin to German may have been the reason why the Germans employed a large number of Jews during their occupation of Poland, although a great many of the Poles with a good knowledge of German could have been found. There is this difference, however, that the Poles only served the Germans by compulsion, as they considered them to be their enemies.
Yeah, so that the Jews were quite willing to work for the Germans, and they could speak to them and so on, whereas the Poles, by seeing the Germans as enemy, well, you know, I don't quite blame them, but therefore they kept themselves out of those jobs that they could have had, because they would have looked like traitors, I suppose.
Jews seem to be rather pro-German early in the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading.
Yeah, I read that too, that they were actually for Germany. Yeah.
They turned against them later on after the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah.
Brigadier,
they just want to be with the winner. I mean, they're just always playing all that, you know.
Well, you know, in 1917 or 16, whenever it was, the Balfour Declaration was issued, they decided that they were going to try to bring the United States into the war. And that would change who the winner would be.
Okay.
You see.
Mm-hmm.
Brigadier General Jadwin. During the German occupation of Poland, the Germanic character of the Yiddish vernacular and the readiness of certain Jewish elements to enter into relations with the winning side induced the enemy to employ Jews as agents for various purposes, and to grant the Jewish population not only exceptional protection, but also the promise of autonomy. It is alleged that the Jews were active in speculation in foodstuffs, which is encouraged by the armies of occupation with a view to facilitating export to Germany and Austria. That is, the Jews were the means by which Poland was to be drained of its food supply. Captain P. Wright. But the high day and triumph of the Jews was during the German occupation. The Jews in Poland are deeply Germanized, and German carries you over Poland because Jews are everywhere. So the Germans found everywhere people who knew their language and could work for them. It was with Jews that the Germans set up their organization to squeeze and drain Poland. Poles and Jews included, of everything it had. It was in concert with Jews that German officials and officers toward the end carried on business all over the country. In every department and region, they were the instruments of the Germans, and poor Jews grew rich and lordly as the servants of the masters. But though Germanized, the accusation of the Poles that the Jews are devoted to Germany is unfounded. They have no more loyalty to Germany, the home of anti-Semitism, than to Poland. The East Jews are Jews and only Jews. It has seemed certain that one of two, the German or the Russian Empire, must win, and that the Jews, who had their money on both, were safe. But the despised Poland came in first. Even now, the Jews can hardly believe in its resurrection, and one of them told me it still seemed to him a dream. Mr. Morgenthau does not touch this matter in his report. 4. With reference to the boycott, the method by which the Poles sought to liberate themselves from the Jewish stranglehold. Sir Stuart Samuel.
This boycott dates from shortly after the by-election for the Duma, which took place in Warsaw in 1912. During the war, owing to the scarcity of almost everything, the boycott diminished, but with the armistice it revived with much of its original intensity. A severe private, social, and commercial boycott of Jews, however, exists among the people generally, largely fostered by the Polish press. In Lemberg I found there was a so-called social court presided over by M. Brzezinski, a former Austrian vice president of the Court of Appeals, which goes so far as to summon persons having trade relations with Jews to give an explanation of their conduct. Below will be found a typical cutting from a Polish newspaper giving the name of a Polish countess who sold property to Jews. This was surrounded by a mourning border, such as is usual in Poland in making announcements of death.
Translation. Quote, Countess Anna Jablonowska, resident in Galicia, has sold her two houses, Stryjska Street, numbers 18 and 20, to the Jews, Dogolevsky, Hubner, and Erbsen. The attorney of the countess was Dr. Zedzic. Her administrator, M. Naszkowski. Will the Polish public forever remain indifferent and passive in such cases? So it's an advertisement complaining about how a Polish countess has sold her houses to Jews.
Exactly. And that's one of the most damaging things that we do, you know, that our people have done, is to, they don't want certain pieces of property anymore. And they get the best deal from Jews. They don't mind, you know, they just to enrich them, to take care of themselves. They sell it to Jews.
Yep.
They're finished with it. That's how Jews get, I've gotten hold of all this stuff. We've talked about that before.
This illustration of Sir Stuart brings to mind a practice common in England. It is related on page 123 of The Conquering Jew, by John Foster Fraser, published by Funk and Wagnalls, New York, 1916. The housing question in the Whitechapel district has reached such a pitch that there are large blocks of buildings where no English need apply is a common legend. Whole streets are being bought up by Hebrew syndicates, whose first act is to serve notice on all Gentile tenants. It is also worth stating in this connection that some of the feeling which has recently led to race riots in American cities has been engendered by the practice of small Jewish real estate syndicates purchasing a house in the middle of a desirable block, ousting the tenants and installing a Negro family, thereby using race prejudice to depreciate the property in the entire block and render it purchasable by Jews at a low price. Thereafter, the property is lost to Gentile ownership or use. It may be that in Poland, a similar condition exists, which makes the sale of property into Jewish hands a kind of disloyalty to the people generally. Apparently, the Poles think so. Racial prejudice is not a sufficient explanation of such beliefs. There is always something pretty tangible beneath them. The boycott was merely this, an agreement among Poles to trade with Poles. The Jews were numerous, well-to-do, and in control of all the channels of business. They owned practically all the real estate in Warsaw. The Jews claimed that the so-called boycott, the Polish name for it is the cooperatives, was persecution. They called the Polish boycott or persecution.
Yeah, that's classic, isn't it? Oh, boy. You know, they do all this stuff, and then if somebody tries to resist and fight back on it, or they're being persecuted. Nobody would believe that. But let's get this. When is this boycott? Oh, 1916. Okay. That's when this guy wrote about it anyway. In this book, right? This book was written. Okay.
Okay.
So the Poles were, the Poles were fighting back and trying to do something about it. That's good.
Okay. Sir H. Rumbold says, it must be further remembered that under the influence of economic changes and owing to the fact that since 1832 the Poles have not been allowed to hold posts in the government, they were gradually obliged to take to trade, and competition between the Jewish population and the Poles commenced. This competition became stronger when the Russian government allowed cooperation. Wait,
when the Russian government allowed cooperative and agricultural societies to be started in Poland. The cooperative movement is becoming very strong and will undoubtedly form an important part in the development of economic relations in Poland, so that indirectly it will be bound to affect the position of the small Jewish trader. Insofar as the Polish government are able to do so by legislation or proclamations, the boycotting of the Jews should be prohibited. But I would point out that it is beyond the power of any government to force its subjects to deal with persons whom they do not wish to deal with.
Well, not anymore. That's what I have written.
In the United States, we've seen that.
Yeah, we've seen that disappear.
We had our law against selling to whomever you wish passed in 1968, so far as real estate goes. Civil Rights Act of 1968.
Yeah, that you don't have a right to sell to whoever you wish. That's what you're saying, right?
If you actually, that's only applicable if you advertise the property for sale publicly. As long as you can keep the offers private, the government has no say in it.
Yeah. Okay.
I heard Rob Freeman discuss that a couple of years ago about how you can keep a white neighborhood white as long as all the property is sold among people who know each other or have some kind of connection and they don't advertise to the general public. You can do it.
Yeah, you can do it. Then maybe, though, they'd find a way to accuse the whole neighborhood of conspiracy.
That's a possibility, but, because Gloria Allred had some kind of lawsuit against a private club for excluding women or something. So, I mean, you know, any kind of kooky lawsuit these days is conceivable.
Yeah.
But I think it would be difficult for the government to get involved in a sale that wasn't advertised to the general public and to tell them that they couldn't do it. But the main problem that white people have in that regard is we don't have the kind of ethnic or racial network set up that facilitates doing that. We don't
and then if they're suspicious of it going on, then they'll have people call up black people or something, or someone call and say, I hear your house is for sale, you know what, blah blah, and then you say, you know to them, and then they get you on something like that, or am I going off the beam here?
Well, that can only happen if you advertise.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you don't advertise, you don't have to tell the people the truth if they just call you up on the phone or something or knock
on
the
door. If you're not offering it for sale to the public,
mm-hmm. Right.
Then you're not under those restrictions.
Right.
You're not under those obligations.
Yeah, well, we would have to have that silent understanding amongst ourselves like the Jews have, which we don't have at all, except for a few people like in the white movement, in the pro-white movement.
Okay. Henry Morgenthau, however, takes a more reasonable view than his British co-religionist, Sir Stuart Samuel. Mr. Morgenthau says, furthermore, the establishment of cooperative stores is claimed by many Jewish traders to be a form of discrimination. It would seem, however, that this movement is a legitimate effort to restrict the activities and therefore the profits of the middlemen. Unfortunately, when these stores were introduced into Poland, they were advertised as a means of eliminating the Jewish trader. The Jews have, therefore, been caused to feel that the establishment of cooperatives is an attack upon themselves. While the establishment and the maintenance of cooperatives may have been influenced by an anti-Semitic sentiment, this is a form of economic activity which any community is perfectly entitled to pursue. Well, nice statement.
Mm-hmm.
It is not difficult, therefore, to see through the eyes and minds of these five men the situation that prevailed in Poland. 800 years ago, Poland opened her gates to the persecuted Jews in all Europe. They flocked there and enjoyed complete freedom. They were even allowed to form a state within a state, governing themselves in all Jewish matters, and doing business with the Polish government only through their own chosen spokesmen and representatives.
You know, 800 years ago from this writing was 1120, the year. Oh, that, you know, so that's how long the Jews had a flourishing life in Poland. How, mm-hmm. you know, however they wanted it to be. So there's an example of how this whole, the lies that they tell, you know, have taken hold so well. And they're supposed to be the most persecuted people in Europe ever, and particularly in Eastern Europe. Oh, my God, you know. I came upon some pictures looking for images for the program post of these very wealthy-looking Jews in the 1830s in the kind of clothing that they wore then. You know, very elaborate, you know, and they were just Polish Jews. Just said they were drawings, but, you know, just call them Polish Jews.
Okay. The Polish people were their friends, the Jews' friends, evincing neither religious nor racial antipathy to them. Then Europe fell upon Poland, divided her asunder, until in the roster of the nations there was no more Poland, except in the hearts of the Polish people. During this period of Poland's humiliation, the Jews grew to be a mighty power, ruling the Poles, regulating their very lives. The Great War came with its promise of liberation and the restoration of a Polish free government. Great War is how they used to refer to the First World War. The Jews were not favorable to that restoration. They were not Poland's friends. The Poles resented this, and at the signing of the armistice, when they were free to express their resentment, they did so. Many regrettable things occurred, but they were not unintelligible. They had explanatory backgrounds. Even the armistice was not the end. The Bolsheviks from Russia came down upon Poland, and once more, so the Poles strongly declare, the Jews were against the land that had sheltered them for 800 years. These are a few of the facts. Another article will be required to complete the story. In the meantime, enough has been said to show the utter wrong which Jewish propaganda in the United States has done to Poland. But the purpose was not altogether to injure Poland. It was also to blind the American people and cause them to view with equanimity the great influx of those same Jews into this country.
Well, that's the end of the chapter.
Yep.
In the issue of the Dearborn Independent, 30 October 1920. I thought we had moved into 1921, and here we are in 1920. Were we doing 1919 in the beginning? I guess. Okay, this is... they always come up with this stuff afterwards, you know, after it's all over. See, after all these Polish Jews have already gotten into the United States, then they write about them because they're not aware. You know, all this stuff takes us unaware. Of course, not too many other people, nobody else did write about it. But, you know, after it's all done, we look at it and say, this doesn't look good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's what's called learning through experience, isn't it?
Yes. That's what we keep doing.
It'd be nice if we could learn through other people's experience.
You know, that's an old question. That's one of those old discussion questions. My father used to say things like that. It would be nice if I could give you kids, you know, the benefit of my experience. But I've learned that, you know, no matter how much I might try, you have to experience things yourself. People only learn from their own experience. And that is true. Experience is a great teacher. And that's why we need to live and have experiences. We shouldn't shelter ourselves too much, because you don't learn very much that way.
I think it's entirely possible to learn through other people's experience. There were lots of people warning. I mean, also there's the fact that you get a little bit of experience, and you know, some people catch on with just a little bit of experience that letting a bunch of these people into the country is not a good idea, and we need to stop it, right? Mm-hmm. And some people are just a lot more dense and slow to catch on.
And well, that's right.
They all vote, you know, all their votes are worth the same thing.
Now I've got some to fill in here. We just have a couple of minutes left, actually. But to fill in, we were talking about how the actual report, and we should tell the listeners that the actual report is on of the Morgenthau report is on the internet, and a good place to find it is at archive.org. They have it. And I took this, I quoted something from the Jadwin and Johnson report. That's one of the better ones, that talked about that only 18 Jews lost their lives in the actual, what they call the boundaries of Congress, Poland. But the whole territory, they said, but the whole territory that didn't exceed 300. And, you know, they were constantly, the story from the Jews was 2,500 to 3,000, or was it even, you know, maybe higher? No, that was about it. And so they tend to exaggerate by 10. Everything is done that way, you know, exaggerate by 10. And then they said, Jadwin and Johnson said, we were able to arrive at our conclusions from the data furnished by Jewish sources, from answers to specific questions addressed to various Polish ministries, from many conferences with other Polish citizens, and from utterances in the Polish press, and believe that those sources sufficiently disclose the nature and causes of anti-Jewish disturbances without further pro-Polish evidence. Mm-hmm. I can't say why I thought that was important, and maybe just what I happened to look at, so I copied it. But and another thing is that Morgenthau Sr. was considered an assimilationist. Who was critical of Jewish nationalism. And I'm thinking that, that lawyer guy who became a Supreme Court justice, who was the head of the Jewish committee. Now I can't think of his name, darn it. I forget his name. He was supposed to be an assimilationist too. He's come up so many times before.
That was a big thing, apparently, among Jews in Germany in the late 19th century.
Walter Rathenau
was also one, and so was Karl Kautsky.
That's right. But, you know, you can see that as also being that they saw that as the best way to get into white society and get controlling positions in it. That is the best way. You know, we're just like you, and we get along with you. Let's all get along. And those who are that wanted to be separate themselves and be kind of opponents, the Zionists, they had a different. It was easier to be against them, I think. So, well, there we go, another chapter. And next week, ladies and gentlemen, we'll have more on this on Poland.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.